Hi and welcome to Police Stories Podcast. This is a series of short stories about my 28-year career in the UK Police Force. Welcome if this is your first time, and welcome back if you've been before. Amazingly, this is episode 80. 80, it seems incredible. We haven't got that many more to go. And thanks very much for the downloads this week. We've reached several milestones, actually. The first being that we surpassed 25,000 downloads in total, which again is a complete source of amazement. So thanks ever so much. I really appreciate it. And hopefully you found it interesting as we've gone through the various stories. I'm sure some more than others. Secondly, it's New Year's Day where I am. So thanks very much for joining me at the moment. I appreciate it's sometimes it's difficult to hear my stories, particularly this time of year. You know, they can be tough, I know, certainly. So I do appreciate you continuing to come back if this isn't your first time. I'm in the motorhome again. We're still in Portugal. I was in Lisbon last night for New Year's Eve. It was excellent. I thoroughly recommend it. But the one thing of being in the motorhome out and about like this is sometimes it's a little bit difficult to control the background noise. So I hope you won't have too many issues for sure. So we'll get on with this week then. If you remember, I'm still in Police Scotland, and I'm back on response, on patrol, on the uniform patrol, dealing with everything and anything that comes in. We've talked about this several times. We'll see how it goes for time, but we might cover a couple of stories tonight. But the first one we're going to deal with might then tie into a second one, depending on the time. So this first one was a bit of a manhunt. Now, it sounds all very dramatic, you know, and equally it could have been a woman hunt, but it just happened to have been a manhunt. There was a guy that we were looking for. He was very well known to us locally, extremely violent, not only to pretty much everyone he met, whether they were female or, you know, the guy in the pub or whoever it was, been to prison a number of times for violence and serious violence against people. He was a scaffolder. He wasn't like a huge build, but he was, you know, very, very strong, very fit, you know, very sort of wiry guy. And for sure, throughout my career with the various sort of roll arounds I've had with people, the smaller sort of wiry guys are the ones that always cause me most problems. You know, I've had some roll arounds with some absolute monsters. One comes to mind who was, I think he was 6'8" or something. He was like the local rugby prop, and he was like 20 stone. He was ginormous. It took about 6 of us to get him in the van. But the thing was, I think when you have these roll arounds with the big guys, you're kind of half expecting it, you know, to be bad. It's the ones that surprise you, that perhaps you've just gone to with two of you because you think, he's not a big guy, I can handle this, it'll be fine, you know, and then you get a nasty shock. And of course, they can be drug fueled as well. If you remember a few episodes back, we talked about the first night that I worked in Scotland, you know, and I had their roll around with a really small built guy, but he'd taken a lot of cocaine, so he was incredibly strong. And, you know, the strength that someone like that possesses, you know, on drugs is very surprising. Yeah, so this guy had a lot of background to him. I can't actually remember what he was wanted for. It might have been a recall to prison. So basically, sometimes people get let out of prison early, but normally they're on license. So they get conditions, you know, that we'll let you out of prison, you know, 3 months earlier than you're meant to be, but you must, you know, not get arrested or do this or do that or whatever it is, commit further offences. They can put in various sort of things. And I think that's what had happened, if I remember. This guy had come out from prison and he had done exactly that, committed further offences, which instantly breached his licence, which meant he was wanted on this recall to prison. Now, of course, generally, they let you know, the prison, that is the case. So that puts us on the back foot immediately. So, you know, he knew that he was wanted by police. So some of these people don't care, and in fact, you know, will actively sort of almost flaunt it in your face and be seen out and about in the town, in the pubs, and knowing that they're going to be, you know, lifted, and they want to make a scene and they want the drama. But the slightly more sensible ones, you know, keep their heads down, basically. And that's what this guy had done. You know, he'd very much gone to ground. So it was a question of putting in the legwork and basically trolling around the various addresses and locations we had for him. And it's a question of, you know, sometimes you have, you know, they used to be called informants, or now they're called CHISIs, which is like covert human intelligence source. You know, we would actually go to our sort of official informants and say, we're looking for so-and-so, any ideas, you know, and they said, well, I'm not sure, but, I'll ask around, or I'm in the pub tonight, I'll have a speak with a couple of my friends, see if I can figure out where he might be, or whose address he's at, or invariably, you know, he's started a new relationship with a, you know, with a new girlfriend, and she lives up at so-and-so address, so he might be there, you know, so you can start to put these things together and track them down. Now, if they're claiming benefits, for example, that's quite useful as well. Or sometimes you even get a heads up that they've got perhaps a doctor's appointment or something like that, because the thing with claiming benefits is quite often you have to attend the job centre every couple of weeks or so and sign on. Now, if we know that's going to happen, you know, we would have our people sat in the job centre waiting for them. And the moment they've signed on and then left the premises, you know, we'll pounce on them, you know, and sometimes quite literally and arrest them. You know, so there's various ways we can get round that, for sure. And the old-fashioned way is basically the addresses you've got for them, whether that's old girlfriends, drinking friends, you know, whoever it is, you'll start heading round those addresses. Now, a lot of the time, you're sort of 90% sure they're not at those addresses. But what that does is has a knock-on effect, you know, and it's a pretty unpopular tactic. But at the end of the day, to a degree, I don't care, because I'm trying to get this person back in custody. So what would happen is I would go to, you know, his mum's address, his dad's address, his sister's address, his brother's address, his ex-girlfriend's address, you know, everyone. I would be going to everyone he knew's address. And invariably, they'd be telling me, you know, I don't know where he is. I haven't seen him for a year or two. He doesn't keep in contact. You know, he's nothing to do with me anymore. Don't come back again. But I'd be telling him at the door as well, okay, thanks very much. I'll be back in the next few days because I need to see if that's changed. And they'll tell you, well, don't bother coming back, because I'm telling you now, nothing will change. He's not coming up here. And say, okay, I will be back. And I would be back, you know. And basically, it's not harassment, but certainly it's legitimate inquiries. But what then normally happens is that has an effect, because I guarantee all these people that are telling me, you know, oh, you know, we don't speak anymore and what have you, they'll have his contact details. And when you've been up there for the fifth time that week trying to trace him, and they've told you, go away, he's not here, they're getting fed up with it. You know, you're disturbing their dinner, you're making, you know, their life uncomfortable. And to a degree, that's what I want, because I want them to ring this guy and say, look, you want to hand yourself in, because I'm absolutely fed up with the cops coming to my door, you know, once a day looking for you. I keep telling them they're not here, they won't listen, they keep coming back. And likewise, the same for, you know, family members. If the family members are getting on to them saying, look, just hand yourself in and get this done, because I don't want to keep getting bothered. It's embarrassing for me. My neighbours are talking. Why are the police always at your door? So actually, the friends and family will do our job for us, you know. That generally works quite well. We've had, for this particular guy, we had a couple of near misses. We had a couple of phone calls saying, you know, oh, I think he's at this address. And of course, we'd go up there and people say, oh, you've missed him by 10 minutes, you know. And we're trying to establish what car he's driving, you know, is he working, where's he drinking, all these various inquiries. So we'd had a couple of near misses. And then finally, and the other thing was, we'd always talked about previous episodes, resources. You know, knowing the background of this guy and just how violent he was, we didn't want to send, you know, two of our smallest cops by themselves with no possible backup, you know, to an address if we really thought he was there. Because if they came across him and we knew he was a fighter, you know, and pretty handy to say the least, then he was going, you know, they were going to have problems. So it's all about common sense. We would go looking for him seriously at handovers when we had two teams on. So there might be eight cops available, and then, you know, a couple of sergeants. So there could be 10 of you, not all going to the same address, but at least available should we track him down and you know, locate him. And finally, that's pretty much what happened. So there was a hotel, quite a large hotel that was on the seafront in this town I worked in. In its day, was a fantastic building, really, really nice building. But unfortunately, it had fallen on hard times, like a lot of sort of hotels had been bought by somebody and they were slowly doing it up. But it was a mega task. And this place, you know, I dread to think the money you'd have to pour into it to bring it back up to the standard. It was in a prime position. And unfortunately, during COVID, and of course, we talked about COVID last week, what had happened was he'd really fallen on hard times, because you can imagine now the few guests that you were getting have completely stopped overnight. Now, we know that there was, certainly in the UK, there was payouts for businesses, you know, and some people benefited from that. But the one way the owner of this hotel found to make money was to offer himself up as emergency accommodation to the local authority, to the councils, so that when they needed to house someone that perhaps had come out of prison or had become homeless for any number of reasons, they would contact him and say, have you got a room for whoever? Now, this was a big hotel. I don't know how many rooms for sure, but I would imagine probably 50 rooms, you know, so he could take a lot of people. And that's what he did. And I don't blame him, you know, for taking them, you know, taking the money to keep himself afloat. Of course, you know, I totally get it from a business and survival point of view. The issue was, unfortunately, because he now had a hotel full of, I wouldn't say undesirables, but people that have various issues. Unfortunately, what goes along with those people quite often is drink and drug and relationship and domestic type problems. So we were getting a lot of calls to this particular hotel. And sure enough, the call came in from the owner saying that this particular guy we're looking for, he named him, said that he was basically smashing the hotel up. Which was all we needed to obviously get down there. Now, it's not far from the Nick. It was only about maybe 5 minutes blue light run from the Nick, you know, something like that. And we had two cars immediately available. Now, I was crewed up with my normal neighbour, excellent, very experienced cop. And then in the prison van was two much younger in service cops, still very good people for sure, but they didn't have a lot of experience between them, maybe only 2 or 3 years each, something like that. Very competent, but I also knew that they'd never come across anyone, you know, really violent at this point. And that's definitely a factor. Now, obviously, you don't get that experience unless you get out and get stuck in. It wasn't their fault at all, but I also, you know, so I wasn't 100% sure just how much sort of backup they would be able to offer. I was pretty confident in both of them, and certainly my neighbour that I was working with, I knew for a fact, you know, that she was very reliable and going to get stuck in, because we had been involved in this sort of thing before. So we blatted down to this address. The van was slightly ahead of us. I'm talking like, you know, 100 yards. It was just in front of us. I could clearly see it, and we were on blues. Can't remember who was driving. I think I was the passenger, actually, and my colleague was driving. And as we turned the corner and stopped outside the front of this hotel, we saw this guy straight away. We knew who he was. He was coming towards us. You could see he was already very angry. He was shouting and swearing. There was no one else with him, but he was shouting and swearing, you know, generally at himself. Clearly drunk or drugged or something, kind of swaying around. Of course, we come round the corner, big show, blue lights, you know, police van, police car. And that was all he needed, you know, to really get wound up. So we came to a stop. Now, the prison van stopped closer to him than we did. And that put one of my younger colleagues, female colleagues, passenger door almost right by him. And I was really concerned she was going to open the door straight onto him and be attacked immediately, you know, before anyone could even get out of a vehicle to help her. She's a very competent officer, and she didn't do that, you know, sensibly. She just held off. Those 5 seconds is all it took for us to pull up behind her, because then I was able to step out of the passenger seat and shout at him straight away. And that then got his attention, and he was about maybe 20 or 30 yards away from me, something like that. But as soon as he saw us, and particularly me, step out, he turned to us quite deliberately. It was quite cold from what I remember. I do remember it was absolutely pouring rain, and he had some gloves on and long sleeve top, I think, or a jacket, both of which he took off. His he left his gloves on, I think, but he took his jacket off and his shirt, so he's now topless effectively, you know, he's bare chested. And that can only mean one thing. If someone's doing that, you know, they're basically lining up for a fight. You know, he was giving off all the signals. Now, we talked in several episodes before about impact factors, really important when it comes to deciding what level of force you're going to use. And also when you're, they call it tactical writing, when you're actually writing your statement that's going to go to court about what happened. So, you know, if we look at these factors, and we've discussed them before, physically he wasn't a big guy, but the real red flags here, the things we knew, was that, you know, very, very violent, lots of violent history. Straight away, I could see that he was drunk or drugged. You know, he was swaying about, and the way he was shouting and sort of slurring, you know, he was on something for sure. So we've now got a very violent male who has taken some substance, be it alcohol or drugs. He's taken his top off, you know, so he's gone bare chested. And bearing in mind it's the winter and it's pouring down, he hasn't done that because he's hot. You know, he's done that because he's getting ready to fight. And he immediately turned to me, and I could see that he was clenching and unclenching his fists. You know, so there's all these, you know, massive sort of red flags. And while he was shouting and swearing at me, and I'm talking through this with you now, but this all happened in, you know, 5 seconds. But this is the information you have to pick up. And he's literally snarling at me with his teeth bared. Again, all classics when it comes to writing your statements, and also gives us a really good idea of, you know, the level that he's at and where he's going to go from here. So as I stepped out of the car, I had my Parva, my pepper spray. I drew it straight away because, again, we've talked about before, old school, you know, 25 years ago when I joined the police, the only option here was fisticuffs. You know, it would be a nigh on, it wouldn't be a one-on-one fight, you know, but it would be, you know, knuckles, bare knuckles fight, effectively. That's what it came down to. Of course, now we've got all these tools. We've got batons, we've got Parva, we've got Taser, some of us have, you know, depending on where you work and what you're deployed as. So they're all factors as well. Now, I have used my baton on two or three occasions. I've never actually found it that good. And to be honest with you, if you saw them, the telescopic steel baton, you'd imagine them to be very, very effective. But for whatever reason, they're not. Maybe I just wasn't hitting hard enough, I don't know. But two or three times I've full power hit someone on the thigh with them, expecting them to drop neatly into a folded, you know, crumpled heap like we see on the telly. And they basically just bounced off them, and they've stood there and kind of looked at me, you know, which doesn't fill you with confidence. So to be honest with you, my go-to would always be the incapacitant spray, which for Police Scotland was Parva. For other forces, it can be CS. I've used them both, and they both have their good and bad points. But coming back to the story, so I'd drawn my Parva, my pepper spray, and I'd assumed the position, and he'd started walking towards me. Now, rightly, my young female colleague had stepped out of the van now, out of her passenger door, and because his attention was focused on me, she had gone round behind him, because what you want to do is you want to split the target for him. You don't want to all line up in his field of vision, because what you're doing is inviting, you know, yourselves to be attacked. If one can stand, you know, behind his left shoulder, one could stand behind his right shoulder, and then one was, you know, in front of him off to the left, and one's off to the right. You know, he's now got four targets, and it really helps. And whoever he goes for, the other three can then get stuck in. But unfortunately, what she'd done was step directly in between or in line with him and me, so that I knew as I brought my Parva up to fire at my spray, she was basically just behind his head and only, you know, a meter behind him. So having had previous experience of this, I knew that basically I was going to hit her in the face as much as I was going to get him. So that's a big problem. Now, luckily, because of the firearms training I've done, blue on blue, as I've just described, i.e. where, you know, cops shoot each other. And obviously it's also happened in wartime as well, where, you know, two friendly forces fire upon each other, not realising a blue on blue situation. So you have to be very careful with it, but in the firearms, it's particularly important. So I did loads and loads, literally years of training, where it was constantly battered into us about, you know, you never ever line up with a colleague the opposite side of a bad guy or girl. You always step off to one side, so that should I have to shoot and engage, you know, a threat, then obviously my colleague isn't standing directly in line with them, because the bullet may pass through them and hit my colleague, or I could miss and it could hit my colleague. And this was exactly the same scenario, because certainly, unfortunately, both in the Met and in my first force down south, I've had the scenario where a cop has got quite excitable and has basically let everyone nearby have it in terms of the incapacitant spray. So we've all had a bit. You also get a certain amount of splashback if you're very close. It's quite a powerful spray. If it hits someone in the face and bounces back, especially if there's a decent breeze blowing, you might find that half of the cops there also get a really good spray in the face of Parva. And it's happened to me on probably three occasions, so I'm very aware of it. And let me tell you, it is really, really unpleasant. If it's CS particularly, you're just going to have snot and tears and sometimes blood, you know, pouring out of noses and eyes. It's stinging like crazy. It's really painful and unpleasant. So you do not want any of that. You know, CS is, in my opinion, much worse. Parva can be a bit more controlled. And even sprayed in small areas like a police car or a cell, and kind of, you know, half an hour later, that car or cell can be used again. CS is an absolute nightmare. If you sprayed it in a cell, which I've never known happen because of these issues, that cell will be out of commission for like 24 hours because it's horrible. It's really horrible stuff. Anyway, there's another tangent for you. Back to the story. So I shouted to my colleague, who was directly in line, to step to one side. And thankfully, rather than kind of standing there looking quizzical and saying, "What do you mean?" You know, she got it immediately and stepped to one side. And at the same time, now you have about a 10 second burst, a 10 seconds worth of spray in your pepper spray. And you're meant to give 1 to 2 seconds. And I gave him probably a decent sort of 2 second spray directly in his face, literally. It's like a water pistol, effectively, in the eyes, in the nose, you know, in the face. Now, with CS, the target area is the chest because all the nasty chemicals rise up into the face. But with Parva, it's full-on spraying in the face, the eyes, the nose. And I have to say, I got him an absolute treat. It really got him hard. And at which point, by now, he raised his fist to me and told me that he was basically going to kill me, but not quite so politely. And so there was absolutely no doubt or justification needed, or more justification needed for this scenario. So yeah, decent spray in his face, and it immediately reacted, because unfortunately there is a tiny percent of the population, I think it's about 1%, that it has no effect on. You know, you can spray them till the cows come home, no effect whatsoever. Now that must be quite terrifying, because if you got to that point and that's what you're really relying on, it doesn't work, then you've got a real problem on your hands and you're going to have to go old school fisticuffs again. But thankfully he wasn't one of them, so it had a really good effect on him. And you know, he was already kind of screaming in agony and put his hands up to his face. But I was very aware that I've seen this happen, you know, temporarily, you know, again, depending on the person, it could only happen for, you know, 2 or 3 seconds, which is barely enough to take their arm, let anything more. So this was a time, and this again comes back to my firearms training, for sort of fast, aggressive action on my part, on the police's part. This is not the time for, quite frankly, pussyfooting around. You know, you really need to get stuck into these people, because the moment that they're secured and contained and cuffed, everything can calm down and everyone can, you know, sort of gather themselves and relax a bit, and then we can look at aftercare. But until those cuffs are on and that person's secure, he's a very, very dangerous individual. Because what he'd done back in the hotel was basically smash the place to pieces. And for all we know, he had, you know, a piece of glass in his hand. There was lots of smashed glass he could have got. You know, I've seen people with like daggers of glass and things. You know, I had no clue. Did he have other weapons on him? He might have been topless, you know, but he did have jeans on and things, so he could have easily had something in his pockets. And given his background, and he knew he was wanted on recall for prison, these are all those parts of those impact factors when making your decision what level of force you're going to use. So I went fairly high with this. Now, I could have gone higher. I could have gone baton strike to the head, but you know, to me, that wasn't really justified in that scenario, because that's potentially a fatal strike. So it didn't need to go that far, but it did need to be fairly robust, let's put it like that. At which point I stepped forward and I hit him as hard as I could with my elbow to the side of his head. Again, that had the desired effect. The spray had got him in pain and his hands up to his eyes, but he was still up and dangerous. So the elbow strike, which is something we're taught and completely within the rules, you know, took him down. He basically dropped like a stone. which is exactly the intended effect. Now, at that point, you know, completely justified, no problems at all. Now, if I'd have hit him, you know, 20 more times or started kicking him in the head or stamping on him or something, that's where you go over the top and suddenly you move into the realms of you're assaulting someone yourself rather than actually just, you know, restraining them and using, you know, the key words are the minimum force required. So the hit to the head did the job. He dropped like a stone and we immediately pounced on him, and the four of us there. And in fact, because we knew that we were going down for this guy and the rest of the Nick knew, at least another two cars, came down as well. So very quickly in the pouring rain, we had another two or three cops. So there's probably about six or seven of us. Sorry, one issue I've had this week is about a stinking cold and it's only just gone now. Well, virtually gone, as you can hear. So basically, we got him secured. We got him handcuffed. He was bleeding very heavily from both his hands, I think his elbows, his face, all over, because of all the glass and the things he'd smashed in the hotel. He'd put his fist through various windows. So he was basically taken off to hospital. The problem was he continued to be very, very violent in the hospital. And we had to stay there and help restrain him the whole time, to the point that he was so off his head on whatever he'd taken that we had to assist the nurses stitching him up. I don't mean we actually did it ourselves, although I have done that on one occasion many years ago when someone was very bad. Sorry. But we basically had to pin him down and secure his wrist and hold it flat while one of the nurses put, I think it was about 10 or 15 stitches in the sort of palm of his hand, you know, the base of his thumb. He had a really deep laceration there that was pumping blood everywhere, all over the hospital. So he continued to be violent for the whole time. And yeah, real nasty piece of work, basically. But we were very glad to get him in custody, firstly, and secondly, to do that without any officers being injured. And I still say that some of that is down to how we dealt with him, how robustly we dealt with him. Because if you'd have gone there, I guarantee if you'd have gone there and said, oh, would you mind awfully just, you know, calming down, we're going to have to arrest you, I'm really sorry, you know, and all that, he would have attacked you. He would have attacked all of you, and you'd have probably had, you know, four injured cops. I'm sure you'd have got control of it eventually, but there's just no need for that, you know. We're given powers, we're given tools like Parva for a reason, so use them. That's always been my thoughts anyway. So, yes, I think it was dealt with fairly well. He would probably disagree with you. And off he went to prison. And of course, then the merry-go-round continues that a couple of years later, he's back out. The same thing happens, yada, yada. You know, unfortunately, that's just how it goes. But that's the police for you. As I've always said many times before, if you can't deal with that sort of stuff, then it's not the job for you. Okay, thanks very much for listening. Hope you enjoyed that. A little bit shorter today. We'll continue on. In actual fact, that incident possibly had something to do with what happened, what will happen in the next episode. So I'll leave you hanging on that to see what you think about that one. Okay, take it easy. Have a good week. Cheers. Bye.